Thank you for joining us once again for another lunchtime session with data protection people. My name's Ollie. I'm back from my leave. I'm your host for these sessions, and I am joined by two of my esteemed colleagues, Phil Brining and David Holmes. Afternoon, chaps.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Lovely stuff. So we've been running these sessions for a while now. Last week, Phil and Dave, in my absence, ran the first of these twin sessions that we're doing, a bit of a GDPR workshop. So there's plenty to talk about on that today. We do like to record and put these sessions out afterwards in the form of a little podcast for those who can't attend. The privacy notice was on screen for that. If you've got any issues at all with that, do just let us know. And we like to make these sessions as interactive as possible. We always find that, you know, they're better when we get loads of interaction. So any comments, questions, concerns at all, please do either pop them in the chat or just dive in, unmute and get stuck in. It's always better that way. So to get started, I thought we normally do a news section, don't we? But I think this week we'll probably put a pin in that. Just because we've got a few bits to get through this week, and also because it gives us plenty to talk about for our next GDPR radio next week. So I thought we'd start instead with perhaps a little bit of a recap of what you covered last week, Phil and Dave, for those of us, me included, who missed that session.
Dave, would you just run through it, would you, whilst I'm just messing around with this PowerPoint?
Yeah, no, for sure. So hi, Ollie. Thank you for the introduction there. Last week was an interesting one because Phil and I took the session side by side. We normally do this from opposite ends of the country through Teams. Last Friday, we were able to both come together in the office in Leeds and to run the show, sat next to each other. We were certainly looking at many areas in how we can help as kind of a workshop and how we can help, how we should be thinking about a kind of compliance and compliance management and how we demonstrate some of those things. And this is one of the slides here that Phil's just kindly demonstrated on screen. So this is, your light come on. I don't know if you're going to jump in there.
No, I was. Does a light come on? I wish it did. And then there was a light bulb moment.
You get the blue ring around your iPhone
I was just saying we were sitting side by side doing this session last week, and everyone has, I would say, funnily if not unkindly, likened us to Laurel and Hardy, and who else did we get likened to? Smith and Jones and the Muppets. which was quite funny, wasn't it?
It certainly was. I certainly haven't identified ourselves directly, although I think we know which ones we are.
Yeah, so we went through this, didn't we, with the intention of kind of plodding through, you know, a bit of a workshop around managing compliance. We talked about, there's been quite a lot of people asked for a copy of this poster we showed, this 8.2 data protection poster in the workplace, sort of thing that you get for health and safety. And we said that this week we would drill into four key areas, but that only gives us like 10 or 15 minutes per area. So we said we'd look at breaches, rights, processes, and DPAs, didn't we? So last week, Ollie, what we were doing is we were talking through each of these different areas, you know, coming from the top and responsibilities, so ROPAs. We were showing examples of stuff that we do, and people were contributing some really good ideas about what they do as well. It's a workshop. It's not meant to be a one-way street. This is meant to be a two-way interactive thing. So that's pretty much what we covered last week. So anything further to add, Dave, about last week? Or any questions anybody's got or observations from last week's session?
I found it a really useful session just to kind of go through stuff, bring it front of mind. But like I said, there was some really good chat going on in relation to that. And I would advise as we always try to do with these sessions, it's a platform, it's a forum for people to contribute ideas and to openly unmic and to join in. So if there is any advice or guidance or best practice that you've come across or something that you've found has particularly worked, then please do feel free to unmute and share in that sense. So the the floor's for everybody.
I thought we'd, you know, again, this is meant, we weren't sure, as we said last week, how to do a workshop like this with so many people via Teams. So, you know, we'll do our best to make it useful and interesting. But I thought maybe we'd start off talking about processes, everybody. And again, what we look for in most areas, I'm sure everyone's got this, is a policy, you know, around compliance with the various aspects of the law in respect of processes in this case, and then a procedure. So, you know, appointing, we in our procedure, this is the front cover of our procedure, we written a procedure, which is a templated thing, and all our customers are welcome to use it or use it as a base, then modify it. But we step through the process of selecting processes, you know, appointing processes, managing processes, a decommissioning process, the four principal steps to take as part of that processor journey. And, you know, again, what we like, because we're simple souls, is we like pictures. So, you know, the process, the procedure, you know, discusses each of these steps and sets out, you know, the steps to take and who's responsible for taking them. But ultimately, you know, what we've got also in the procedure is a flow chart to give people an overview of the process. Now, I think it's possibly worth discussing some of these critical points in here. I mean, everyone understands that the contracts have got to be the contracts, and there are some good templates out there. Really, that one of the key bits is due diligence. You know, so again, I don't know how people approach this, but there's a number of different ways. Again, don't everyone dive in when you want to, but what we see most of the time is some kind of questionnaire. Again, this is our templated questionnaire, or some of it is. You see, you probably can't see it, runs to 10 pages. So it's quite a meaty thing. But I think one of the things that'll come out of today is it's horses for courses. You know, if you've got a small processor with a low risk, you know, you wouldn't want them necessarily to fill out a 10-page questionnaire. You might have a one-sider, or you might actually ask them for an attestation of compliance, you know, so they would state themselves. It depends what you want. And when I'm doing training about this area, I kind of show this is a picture of one of Google's data centers. Note the cameras, the spiky fence, and you know, the high fence, the turnstiles, the lack of windows in the building, etc. And this is a data center I was asked to go and do a risk assessment of a few years ago now, to be honest. And you know, you can see that it's above a fast food outlet. When I got there to do the audit, that blue door, which is where the data center was open, and the bottom left hand panel of the door was actually booted in. And when I went in, I just wandered straight in, and the MD was hanging out of this front window having a fag, and there was a bike in the hallway, and there was a room of surrounded, you know, this is like benches all around the outside, and about 15 techies were sat in there typing away. And I went into the MD's office, which is the front writer ground floor, first floor window, and there was a big cardboard box, I kid you not, on the middle of the floor, and there was a stack of servers sat on it, and all the lights were lit, and that was the data center. And I got sent down to do a risk assessment of this place, and it's a basket case. So, you know, you know what's your due diligence to determine where your data center is? You know, you've got to make a choice. So
yeah, on that, Phil, is it worth maybe just kind of going back a little bit and kind of looking at, possibly, unless we're coming up to it, what when you talk about what due diligence, what actually is due diligence? I know you're kind of looking at, do we use Google behind fences, and do we look at and that kind of stuff. But are we, when we're talking about due diligence, are we talking a risk assessment? Are we talking just asking questions and accepting responses? Are we talking due diligence as in probing? So somebody says, yes, we've got, I don't know, 27,001 accreditation. Do we just go, fair enough, thank you? Or do we actually say, well, can we see certification on 27,001? So when we talk about due diligence, and I'm more than happy for others to jump in, or Ollie or Phil's got comments, but what actually is due diligence? Have we got a common understanding of that?
Yeah, and I know, you know, when we do supplier audits, I'm always nagging on saying, you know, what's the objective of doing this? What is it we're looking for? So if we're doing a supplier audit, you know, we're looking as a third party privacy firm at the risk that poses to our client. You know, we're not necessarily interested in all the aspects of the internal, you know, workings of that process in their role as a controller, we're only interested in what risk do they pose to us, I think, and I might, you know, stand that out there to get knocked down. So therefore, I'm mostly interested and concerned about security, you know, and access control. And, you know, now, you know, from a compliance point of view, the location of data and those types of processes that, and controls that are in place at the processor that will directly have a negative impact on me as a controller if there's a problem. And if they haven't got their own privacy notices right for their employees, that's less of an issue, isn't it? If they're not registered with the ICO as a controller, less is of an issue. But it's their role as a processor, I think, that is most important to assess.
I think you're right, and I think it's looking at that from a risk-based approach, isn't it? The GDPR expects us to take a risk-based approach, and are we taking a risk-based approach to our processes? And for the greater the processing or the greater the risk, do we do greater due diligence or take due diligence steps in that sense? But I'm just concerned sometimes that you see from due diligence questionnaires and that kind of approach that there's just a simple acceptance of the response. So you ask an individual, do you take care of data? Yes, we do. We've got a policy on GDPR and we're all fine. And you see some people not naturally taking it much further than that. So would that in itself be due diligence? Or is that just a simple assurance or a simple kind of confirmation from the individual without necessarily stress testing that?
It's difficult because I take your point, Dave, but, you know, what's the alternative to a degree? We haven't necessarily all got the time to go out and audit processes or the resources to do that. So I suppose it's a case of where do you draw the line on this? I know you say risk-based approach, but, you know, in practice, what does that look like?
Because we've had, in fact, the company had, I think Phil undertook the process for one of our clients where you had to go and audit a data centre. I don't think it was that one, it was one in York.
I've only done three where I've been... Four, I think, where I've been sent on site to assess data centres. This one, interestingly enough, that I showed you the pictures of there, was a firm that was, I was working in a football club at the time, and this firm that worked here took the entire fan databases from 25 of the top football clubs and rugby clubs in Europe, and they mashed all the data up overnight. So took the retail fee, the ticketing fee, the, you know, all these other different fees, website registrations, and they deduplicated it and they published what they called a single customer view, you know, what fan, you know, what relationship they've had with the club. So that was then used for marketing. So there was literally millions of records on this stack of servers that were sat in this cardboard box. You know, I think high risk processing. So I got sent down there to have a look at this data center. That football club that I was working for sent me another place in Manchester to a data center, which they were just using as backup. And again, it wasn't a proper data center. It was just an office with a cupboard in it with servers in. But then I got sent to have a look for one of your clients, Dave, a data center in Manchester, Telecity, which was really good, except I managed to walk into somebody else's cage unchallenged. And then they sent me to Bytemark in York, which also was very good as a data center. So, you know, you don't have to go yourself, you know, and also when you get there, what is it you're looking for? You know, some obvious stuff like this number 86 on, I think it was Dean Street, you know, had obvious failings, but you're going to a professional data center, you know, what are you looking for? So maybe commission somebody else to go on your behalf to do the audits, you know, the assessments, but you can't, it's a snapshot in time that you're seeing as well, but you can't really get better than I've been out there, I've seen it, I've met with the people, I've got a good feel for the place. Reading what submitted on a questionnaire is all well and good, but as you say, Dave, it's limited. But it's better than nothing.
Because at the end of the day, as you know, through the Article 28 conditions, as a controller, you retain the liability or sort of potentially retain some of the liability for the acts and omissions of the processor or for following your guides or your requirements and things. So how much due diligence do you need? And it is a risk-based approach. And you maybe need to work through what the risk-based approach is and maybe document that within a procedure where if it's only small scale, small number of records, a small processor, in that sense, that you document your procedure and say, well, actually, with this, as an organisation, we're choosing that this is going to be a lower level form of due diligence. But for example, if we're going to appoint a new CRM system, that we may want a higher level of due diligence, for example.
Yeah, the ICO's view, I think, looking at you know, where they've been critical of due diligence, they've definitely been critical of people who've relied on contractual conditions, like, you know, where they've said in their contract that they will comply with the law, and the ICO has said, well, that isn't good enough. But I don't think I've seen anything where somebody said, well, look, we filled in this, we had them fill in a security questionnaire and we reviewed some of the documentation. I don't think I've seen any cases the ICO has issued enforcement notices or monetary penalty notices where there's been that next step of due diligence, but certainly they've said relying on a clause in a contract isn't good enough.
No, for sure. And I think by analogy, you could say just relying on a simple response to a question may not be sufficient in the same sense.
Well,
it'd be interesting to see if anything was ever challenged.
I just got across you today, but I want to dive in there, because what they did say in the Marriott fine is because Marriott had got two audit reports from a third party auditor, QSA, under the PCI-DSS, they allowed that as mitigating circumstances. So I think if you can demonstrate you've got an audit of the processor, you're on reasonably solid ground.
I would agree, and I would also partly disagree. I think it's I would agree you've done an audit, but is it an audit? Is it a simple assurance check? Are you simply just asking questions? So I think it depends what you define as an audit in that sense, and whether you're stress testing some of the questions to make sure that in order to give yourself assurance that the questionnaire has been filled in competently by an individual that understands the process and the purpose behind it, not necessarily just a tick box, well, I've got to get through this before you pay me kind of process.
So I think it's
a risk-based approach. I think there's got to be some kind of determination behind or an assessment behind, well, what are actually doing, what is the process actually doing, how much information are they getting, how regularly are they getting, how are they getting it, and then deciding on the back of that the level of due diligence that you afford to that. Because I would and it's possibly me, I may be more slightly risk averse than others in that sense, but I'd like to think that if there was an issue, it may well be stress tested to say, well, why did you just simply accept somebody's terms in that sense, as opposed to actually, well, can you demonstrate that? Since the GDPR is premised on can you evidentially demonstrate you've done something, well, do we ask our processes to evidentially demonstrate that they've done something?
Can be quite time consuming. Then again, this flowchart is simply a bringing to life a process, and each controller's got to design their own process, haven't they? Procedure that they take in their own operations. So, you know, they might have more elaborate steps, or they might have fewer steps. Who knows?
For sure, and it's certainly an interesting point. I'd be interested to see if anybody's got any opinions for those who are listening in as to how far they take their own due diligence measures, just from devil's advocate, really, whether it's a simple process, just to ask a few questions, we take reliance on that, or whether we do any stress testing.
The other, how about Google's hiding behind legalese? I'm not sure I get that. I'm all about that one over there. The other, only other area that I wanted to pick up on.
Can I?
Of course.
I wanted to just say something in respect to this kind of big company data centers versus like smaller shops. Even the bigger shops where you'd expect top compliance and top certifications, basically, sometimes they're like, they don't allow for an in-person audit because they say, oh, we've done everything that we should, and our auditors say we're tickety-boo solid, and we don't feel the need to allow you to inspect our premises, you know?
I think that is probably acceptable if you can demonstrate that they've got the controls in place. So you can imagine a company like Salesforce or Microsoft, you know, and they have, you know, 130,000 or more customers, and they all want to come and have a tram around their London data center. They're going to say no. You're by allowing that, it's actually a security risk, and I kind of buy that. But then what those companies do is they provide you with their I don't know why that's dropped out of there. Their SOC 2.
Those kind of Marriott audits, which said everything was okay when in fact it wasn't. So yeah, in the end, I just wanted to raise it as an issue that fundamentally, just because they're big and seem professional and bulletproof, still might not be okay from our standpoint of wanting to make sure that everything is indeed in order in our own independent view.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. I mean, my experience limited is that, you know, the bigger organizations probably are pretty good because their whole business model depends on security, and the little ones, some are good and some are bad, and the middle-sized ones, you know, probably aren't quite as good as they'd like to think they are, but that's a very broad generalization. The only other bit I wanted to highlight on here was this kind of, you know, is a processor already on our register? You know, yes, they are. Well, for what? You know, because we have to catalogue the nature of the processing and the all that type of stuff. So, you know, it's quite conceivable that we end up with the processor doing different stuff, and therefore they might have to go through the approvals process for that different stuff. And I'm not sure that, you know, that always gets picked up in procedures.
I think you're right, and I think you, as a final point potentially on this before we move on, you hit on something there, which is potentially the record-keeping aspect of it, which is something which I've noticed sometimes in smaller organisations in particular, where this procedure or this process can fall down, in that I've literally done supplier review tasks for some of our clients, and we've contacted a supplier that's on their registers, and they've said, we've never even heard of your client. We've never heard of the person you're supposedly doing due diligence for. And you sort of think, well, why on earth is this on your registers then? Or they've not done business with them in like 10 years, but it's still there for some reason.
Yeah.
So I think that's there's clearly an issue there in terms of record keeping.
We did say that we were trying to talk about disclosures and sharing as well at the same time, but we probably won't have time to, will we? But I don't know if there are any points you want to raise on disclosure requests, like from the police or utilities companies or lawyers or other people, you know, third parties, or anything on data sharing. Obviously, the different set of rules, because they're less well defined in the GDPR, aren't they?
From my point, I think it's just making sure that it's logged. So if you've got regular sharing or regular disclosure, you've got a log to demonstrate that, whether it's through your processors or your controllers. But if you've got ad hoc sharing, you get utility companies potentially asking for new address details because an individual's moved and they've got an obligation to address their own debt management or some other obligation like that, then it isn't more of an ad hoc request. But I just think they all need to be logged. It needs to be an official request and kind of recorded and documented just to demonstrate that you've considered it and you've supplied information following a bit of justification.
Yeah. I tell you, I had one last week, I think it was, when we were in the office on Friday, you and I, last week, somebody rang in and said they've had an email from the police asking to disclose information about a tenant. And I said, well, that doesn't feel right to me. You know, usually the police submit a request on a form and it's countersigned by an inspector, in my experience. So, ideally, you would have that set out in your procedure that, you know, we've got a data sharing protocol with all these different organisations, and we expect, you know, it to come in officially in writing with the you know, reason for the sharing. Now, the person at the police had misquoted the Data Protection Act as being why they wanted the data. So I have had them in the past, you know, and again, worked in sport, you know, we had requests from the police. We had one in that came on an old form with an old logo for Merseyside Police on it, and we were really suspicious, and it turned out to be a duff, you know, unauthorized request. So I have seen them in the past.
Yeah, I've certainly seen them as well, but I always check for the same reason, that it's officially documented and signed from an inspector, if it's from the police or from another body, that it's official, and that you've gone through that little bit of an assessment process to make sure it's validated in that sense.
Yeah, and I think I found a little bit of confusion. So, you know, again, the police are quoting, you know, we need this for our, you know, their piece in the Data Protection Act, you know, whatever their relevant section is in the law enforcement directive, effectively. But from a, you know, where you've been requested, let's say you're a controller, you've been requested, your lawful basis isn't the same as theirs. Your lawful basis for the disclosure is potentially a legitimate interest of that third party, isn't it? So again, I find sometimes a degree of confusion around the police saying, I need it because of detection of crime. And everyone says, oh, this has to be disclosed because of detection of crime. No, you know, this is being disclosed for the legitimate interest of the third party who's requesting it, for therefore it's a legitimate interest. And, you know, it appears to be necessary for the disclosure to occur, otherwise it's going to prejudice their investigation. So again, I sometimes find there's a bit of confusion around that as well, and a reticence to kind of look at these things and say, yeah, that seems a valid request. I can see why they want it. I can see it's necessary, and therefore we're going to do it.
For sure. I've pushed back with a couple of clients where you get requests in. I can't remember exactly what the laws were now, but I've looked into the laws and some really odd and strange ones, and you kind of go, I'm not quite sure how that is actually relevant to what you're asking for. So it's just kind of pushed back a little bit to challenge the basis of what they're offering under.
We'll move on to DPAs, if everyone's okay. I can't remember what we talked about on DPAs. Let's see. So again, DPA, we would expect a policy, you know, which basically say we're going to do DPAs when we're required to do them, and a procedure that says in order to do a DPA, you know, you go through this process, which might include a screening or whatever. And then eventually, you know, there's probably a set of forms that people will use to record and to guide the DPA. And in this case, you know, something as simple as installing over CCTV, it might be a really simple form. And I saw a fab example of this at housing association in I think it was Somerset, Knightstone, quite a few years ago. And it was absolutely, they had this down to a T, it was great. But something a bit more complicated, again, this is getting smaller and smaller, you might have, you know, a bigger form with a screening questionnaire and different questions. And when you get into a supremely complicated data protection impact assessment, then you might actually forget all the standard forms and write up a report, which is what we do when we're doing something on a really complicated thing. But again, what I'm trying to get across is, in our opinion, you know, it's horses for courses, and your procedures operationally need to reflect that. Dave, you've done lots of DPAs, haven't you? What's your wisdom on this?
I can fall out with them. Not necessarily because I disagree with them, but it's just because they're potentially being used in the wrong sense. So you see, if you look at the strictest senses from a DPIA, it's for high-risk processing areas, but you see people doing DPIAs on things that aren't necessarily caught by high-risk processing and still putting them through a stage one, stage two process. Now, it's only a little pearl of wisdom, if anything. Has anybody actually identified that the stage one process is simply just working through whether you're high-risk processing or not? It's nothing other than if you answer yes to one of these, you're more likely to be high-risk processing, and therefore stage two is applicable. You need to go through and do a full DPIA. But for individuals or for organisations that try to just DPIA everything because I think that's the approach, or that's the approach they've taken, stage one is rather than redundant, because if you're going to go through stage one answered no, and then the guidance is you don't need to go any further, then they've changed the whole purpose of what the DPIA is, or the DPIA form that they have is used for. So sometimes I find the documentation to be misused. You've answered no to a range of preliminary questions. You've identified that you're not high risk processing, then you go, my risk assessment's done, I'm off in that sense. And I don't necessarily see them, stage one is a risk assessment. I think just people need to be mindful of the fact that stage one's insufficient if you're using them outside of the strictest senses of a DPIA.
Yeah, you're right, David. I mean, we've been kicking this around this morning, haven't we? Over quite a long email chain now, in respect of one of our customers who's been conducting screening checklists against, well, to be honest, their policy seems to be that they conduct a DPIA screening checklist against virtually everything they do, which sometimes means that they conduct them against specific policies or procedures and send them to us and say, what do you think? And we've been kicking this around this morning and, well, why are they doing this? What's the use behind it? Is there potentially something more to it? And it can be quite complicated. I think if a lot of it probably comes down to training, I would argue. I don't know what you think the root cause might be on this, chaps, but just a lack of understanding potentially of what these are actually used for and when they need to be done.
I would support that. I think partly if you use a DPI and the structures of sensors, it's to identify if you're high risk processing, and if so, then you do stage two, which focuses purely on the high risk processing activity. But the law or the GDPR also requires to understand the risks that presented by your activity generally. So I wonder whether people are thinking, well, if I have to do a risk assessment, let's just do a DPI and everything, without necessarily considering if that's the approach you're taking, you might need to modify what you're using, because you're fundamentally changing the purpose of it. In that sense. And likewise, I think we're talking about, and we've seen before people doing risk assessments or DPIs or trying to do DPIs on a policy. Well, surely the DPI has to be focused on the procedure or the process activity, not the document itself. And then I think some people just need to, potentially down to training, I agree with you, Ollie, whether we more awareness about what a DPI is, when we use them, what, when they're applicable and that kind of thing.
What do you find about the depth that people go to when they're filling it in? Because again, I all too often I'm asked to review a data protection impact assessment. I read it and I can't really understand the processing. I don't get my head around the data flows. I can't see where the potential risks are because it's not they're not articulated to such a depth. And that smacks of, right, I've got to do one of these, I'll just fill it in superficially and bang, off it goes, get signed off and away we go. Well, there's no point in doing one like that, is there?
No, for sure. Yeah, and I was looking at one the other day, and it was a DPI was conducted, and I find that there's insufficient detail. And then just by way of example, it was only when I got into kind of halfway through stage two that I actually identified what the actual activity was. And it would have been a lot easier. And kind of the feedback was, well, that kind of detail, and I mean, I'm a detailed person, which probably doesn't help, but you need a full explanation at the beginning of what's happening in order to enable an understanding as you then progress through the document. Trying to find, once you've got 60% way through the document, what the actual activity is, isn't very particularly helpful. In that sense. So I find it's just a lack of detail.
Yeah, Fiona's dead right. She put a comment in that the main issue is getting the right people around the table to answer the questions you've got. And that is exactly spot on. You know, particularly if you did a technical review. So this one on the screen now was, I was asked quite a few years ago to do an assessment of a product called Sprinklr, which was a social media amalgamation platform that one of our clients wanted to use. And you know, none of the forms were, they just don't go into enough detail. I mean, you've got to then get on the phone to Sprinklr, or in Germany or in America, and so on and so forth. So getting the right people around the table is really hard, and often people you're talking to don't know the answer to the questions.
I think it's a really good suggestion, actually, because it's if you look at a DPI being a risk assessment, how many people are trained in identifying and mitigating risks? So are the people sufficiently trained in completing them? In that sense, have they had risk training, for example?
Yeah, and that's my problem with forms, because the forms lead the writer, you know, the author, you know, maybe he's got some examples. There's the ICO's form, and I looked up some this morning, and they've got examples of risks. Well, you're tempted to just fill those in and then, oh, I can't think of any more, and move on.
For sure. I've certainly seen some of that seem quite weak. From not just the detail in there, but the risk identification and the risk mitigation as well. So when you're looking at, well, the mitigating steps within the document, how do we mitigate risks in that sense, and the range of mitigations that can be required. It's the reason why I'm labouring on it is because quite a few moons ago, I used to audit health and safety, and I was on a health and safety committee in bits and pieces for making sure the organisation was safe from a health and safety point. The individual that trained us was a guy who's heavily qualified in health and safety, and he criticised the organisation quite heavily because the individuals that at that point, which were meant to be completing the risk assessments, had no risk assessment training, and he criticised them quite heavily. And as a consequence of that, I was then nominated and put through IOS training for completing health and safety risk assessments. And you could use the same analogy here. Who are we asking to complete risk assessments, and have they been sufficiently trained in identifying risks? Otherwise, does that water down and reduce some of the benefit of completing them in the first place?
Yeah, I'm just going to pick on Ollie here. So we've done a few risk assessments, let's call them, for one of our clients who's an online e-commerce platform, and they use all sorts of people to supply them with data, you know, so the buy data in from brokers. And again, they've asked us to have a look at that, haven't they? But traditional DPA doesn't really work because that's looking more about compliance risk than privacy risk, and trying to differentiate the two things there. So, you know, this one again on the screen is on a platform which was in America. So we were really interested in looking at the lawful grounds for processing and the contract in the MSA, master service agreement, between the two parties. And most of those things, if you're not careful, get missed on a privacy impact assessment because, you know, they're not obvious. They're going to potentially impact on privacy, but they might impact on a controller's data protection compliance position. So we've done quite a few of those, haven't we? And we've kind of fed back, you know, these people are a basket case, and these people are probably all right. But again, they need documents in a different way, don't they?
No, you're spot on. I mean, the thing that's tricky about that is that you do require sort of quite a decent degree of training and experience in completing these sorts of things to really get the answers that you need. So one of the key examples with that particular client is I did one a risk assessment, a DPIA, a while ago on a new piece of kit they wanted to use, which was, I think I mentioned this some time ago, but essentially a cross-app tracking system to basically reattribute app installations, basically pay their advertisers effectively. And when this first came through, the supplier was sort of very adamant that they didn't process any personal data and that you didn't need consent from the user to use this piece of kit. Now, you know, you could go through and do a risk assessment based on that, and you could maybe flush out and think, well, actually, no, maybe this does constitute personal data that you're using. But really, you know, once we got into it, of course it processed personal data. It had to in order to work, even if it wasn't direct identifiers, it was sort of unique reference numbers, but still personal data. And it absolutely did need consent from a PECA perspective, and particularly since, for those who might be aware, iOS 14.5 came in, absolutely needed consent. But you need to have sort of the training and the understanding to be able to dig those issues out, because otherwise, if you just sort of follow the form through its processes, you might miss something like that. And then before you know it, you've embedded a piece of kit into your systems that you don't understand properly, or that might be a compliance risk. So it's something that you really have to get right, and you have to get right at an early opportunity, to be honest.
Just a quick one back then, just looking at, you mentioned there you got a data protection impact assessment, and I think you mentioned within the discussion there, a privacy impact assessment. So is there a difference between the two?
Well, it's all sort of semantics, isn't it? But I think the way I've always envisioned it, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, is to say that a data protection impact assessment is a... it's a statute, it's a term that's defined in statute, isn't it? It's article, I'm going to show myself up now, 35. And it's a requirement, but a privacy impact assessment could be anything. It could be a lighter touch risk assessment where you just work through some of the compliance risks. That's the way I've always seen it. And again, that's something which maybe it's a communication issue that we're constantly banging on about DPIAs rather than risk assessments. Because I've had instances where I've been asked to review a screening checklist for a particular new piece of software or whatever it might be. And I've said, well, no, you probably don't need to do a DPIA according to the statutory requirements. However, you really should be doing some sort of risk assessment on this, because fundamentally it's still, you know, it's not low risk processing. You've still got quite sensitive data being involved. And you sort of get the response back of, well, how on earth do we do that? So I don't know whether it's a training thing, like we've said, or perhaps a communication thing, but it's certainly a pain point, I think, DPIAs in most organisations.
Yeah, for myself, I generally think it's probably more of a potentially moot point.
Right.
In relation to privacy impact assessments, and if you're looking at privacy impact assessment, are you just involving, are you just focusing purely on privacy? So is it narrower than what a DPIA would be when you're focusing on data protection as a whole? So a DPIA may include privacy, but would a privacy impact assessment necessarily contain the wide relevance of data protection in that sense? I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, Phil.
Well, only that, you know, this document on the screen was done in 2017, and this is old money because they used to be called in, since we were introduced in 2007. a privacy and badge assessment. And I have to say, the ICO did some fabulous work in the early days, I think. Their first guide, that A5 landscape blue and yellow guide, was brilliant. And I think they've got progressively weaker as they've gone on. And, you know, the data protection impact assessment, you know, I know that, you know, the law tends to lead you to think about risk to privacy, and it doesn't tend to lead you to think about risk to data protection compliance from a controller's point of view. And so one of the questions that's missing from the ICO's template is, you know, how does this processing stack up against the 7 data protection principles? Well, that's to me an obvious no-brainer. That, you know, why are you not asking, you know, is this fair and lawful? Maybe it's just implied that you will. So I think they're the same thing. I was talking semantics, really. PIA was the old way of terminology, and DPIA is a new way of terminology. I think there is, in my mind, a slight distinction, but it's only in my mind. I suppose everybody else's mind and in popular commentary.
No, for sure, for sure.
No, absolutely.
There's some good comments on the chat about. Sorry, Ollie, good comments on the chat about it.
No, absolutely. That's what I was about to say. And the only other thing being that unless anyone has got anything else to contribute, I think we should probably move on to the next topic, Phil, because I'm aware that we've done about 45 minutes and we're about halfway through what we wanted to discuss for this session.
Well, we're going to talk through breaches again. Breaches is a nice area because, you know, you can define a policy of how to handle security incidents and personal data breaches as we have in our template, and then a procedure, you know, to talk people through that, you know, in the event this happens, and this is what you have to do. And that's the sort of thing that you set up and train people in. And I know this looks a little bit complicated. This is kind of mashed together, but this again is a way of visualizing, you know, the initial steps, you know, and then has a personal data breach occurred. This arrow off to the left as you look at it is kind of a detailed, you know, our technical measures, security, or organizational measures being breached. So that takes you through a little decision making tree there. But ultimately, you know, you undertake a risk assessment, which is the middle piece, and then determine, you know, whether the risk is unlikely to arise. And again, all the language here is really complicated. I've added in two bits that, again, that I think is worth highlighting. Check that you got any contractual terms that you might have to report, you know, a breach or an incident to a joint controller or a processor, or if you're a processor to a controller. And the other area is, you know, you might have to notify the ICO, but you might also have to notify another EU supervisory authority. So again, I think everyone understands breaches. I think they understand the time criticality of it. And, you know, it's a pretty straightforward process. But the tricky bit is doing the risk assessment and deciding whether or not, you know, it's reportable.
I would agree with that, Phil. But one thing that stands out for me is when you look at policies and procedures around breaches, is the difference between reading a letter blurb and helping people understand it and visually looking at what you've got on screen at the moment, which helps to simplify the process. The detail can still be there, it can still be backed up, but I actually do really appreciate the kind of the process flow steps to help people and to aid understanding. I think it's represented in a great way.
I find that sometimes people, including people who probably should know better and are employed by us, get mixed up between, you know, this and DPIA. So I find people saying to me, but it's not a high risk to individuals, so it's not reportable. No, that's not what it says. You know, that's what DPIA says, but that's not what personal data breach says. It says, is there it's reportable unless the risk is unlikely to arise. That's effectively what it says. So risk to any data subjects in theory is reportable, isn't it?
That's my interpretation, because in order to make breach reporting mandatory, it basically says all breaches are reported unless it doesn't result in a risk in that, or however it's worded. I'm not trying to paraphrase there at all, but in essence, it's worded in that way to make it a mandatory requirement, as opposed to, well, make an assessment and then determine something, and if you then have to, then let us know, in that kind of sense. So I always look at it as, firstly, breaches are reported internally. That's a must. The ISO will look at your breach registers and logs. And I have a few issues with individuals that's got empty breach logs, because we're only humans, human error will occur. So I'd expect to see some minor elements on there, at least in that sense. And then you assess the issue, the incident, when it comes through to you, and you make the relevant judgment or assessment as to whether the notification requirement's been met. And if the notification requirement's been met, then you need to notify the ICO within the realms of the GDPR.
So, yeah, sometimes the security incidents procedure is separate from the personal data breach procedure. But I like to join them together because I think that, you know, one results from the other. So sometimes the security incident procedure is part of the ISMS, or in some cases part of the PCIDSS compliance management regime. But I always kind of advise people, I would make one procedure so that everyone can understand the one process.
I would agree. I think it limits the ability for individuals to get confused with, well, what process am I following to report this? Or for them to have an awareness of what's actually happened from a security point, and has that security, or is the security incident necessarily compromised personal data, or shall we just push it all through one system so it all gets assessed, regardless of whether it's a security incident or a personal data breach, and let the team that are trained and knowledgeable make that determination for you.
So what's your experience on this risk assessment piece then? You know, again, we've kind of here just split out to try and help guide for, you know, what are the risks, you know, physical material, non-material or other. Add a comment in, i.e., you know, the risk is this, define the risk, and then what's the likelihood and what's the severity. So again, we see matrices where they're scoring the risks, and a policy of anything that scores below a certain level, you know, doesn't get reported, and anything that scores above a certain level does. What's your experience of, or anybody, of dealing with risk assessment? Is it a difficult process, an easy process, a distributed process, a centralized process?
It's and I'm happy for anyone to jump in, but just to answer your question, I think it's a difficult one, particularly on the scoring matrix thing, because I can understand why that would be a desirable way to go about it. But the problem is that all too often, you know, breaches can, they're so context specific and they can vary so wildly within, you know, that dynamic, that it can be quite hard to quantify that. And I've seen instances where sometimes the factors used to quantify levels of risk or likelihood of risk, either for reporting to the ICO or reporting to the data subjects, is just wrong. On one form, I remember we looked at this with Jasmine. We noticed that the controller was giving different scores depending on the number of people involved. And that was a crucial factor in determining the likelihood of harm and the severity of harm, and whether it was reportable. But fundamentally, that's not necessarily relevant. You can have an incredibly serious high risk breach that only affects two people. And conversely, you could have an incredibly low risk people that affects hundreds of people. So unless it's calibrated really clearly and really well, it's going to lead you to make mistakes, I think, unfortunately. Yeah. As I say, I can definitely understand the impetus, but it has to be done very carefully, I think.
I remember the ICO fining, I think it was Prudential, £70,000, this is in the old DPA as well, for sending pension letters to two, you know, incorrect pension letters to two people, got their name, the details mixed up. So that was just two individuals. You know, so I agree. I'm not convinced that the number of people whose personal data has been compromised is of any relevance at all, because I don't read Article 33 like that. I think it says, you know, is there a risk to data subjects? You know, one or more? Yes. Well, you know, it's reportable. And the ICO probably says, as we found when we do report things, thanks for letting us know. Keep us in touch. Don't they? They don't come down in like a ton of bricks. They're not interested in the small human error type things, as we've found. They're interested in more in the big systemic, you know, it should have been avoided breaches.
Yeah, you're right. And I think part of that, and then there's a sort of side effect of that, which I was going to bring up, which I think is slightly unhelpful, is that a lot of the time I see these processes that really, and obviously I understand why, but that really ramp towards whether it's reportable or not. And that's really the absolute key. Do we have to report? Do we not have to report? But really, you've got to be looking at remediating your breach and understanding why it's occurred and actually taking care of it. And all too often, I've seen instances where, you know, there's a huge panic because we've had a security incident, we've had a personal data breach, we need to work out whether it's reportable. And then as soon as we decide that it's not reportable, then everyone's a bit less interested. And it's sort of, well, all right, file that away, we'll think about that later. It's sort of like, well, no, you've still had an incident, you still need to remediate it, you still need to deal with it properly, make sure your actions are actually, you know, implemented after all this. So I think there can be, again, maybe it's an issue with the perception of really where that risk lies from an organizational perspective. I don't know, but I have come across that in the past as a bit of an issue. I don't know if anyone's got any other thoughts on this at all, and please do jump in. But otherwise, just because I'm aware of time, we should probably have a word on subject rights.
Yes, it was on today. It's kind of in the information governance framework. You know, we when we're auditing, we look for a policy and a procedure. And again, this is an easy area to procedurize, isn't it? Because it follows a specific process. But you know, easy to draw up, and then when it comes to reality, it's another ball game altogether. And there's a split kind of halfway down depending on what type of rights request it is. So, you know, you might be finding information and then erasing it, or you might be finding information and then releasing it, disclosing it to the requester. You might be finding a processing activity and then suppressing it because it's a restriction of processing, or it might be an objection to processing, and you might be finding out, you know, are we processing the information about this individual? And then the action is to balance the rights and then determine whether or not, you know, you're going to carry on or not. So there's definitely a split. We were going to talk more about subject access requests rather than all rights requests. But I mean, basically they follow the same flow, but the bit in the middle is, well, depending on what type of request, depending on what the procedure says, are the steps to take. But ultimately, you know, the requester needs a response, and ultimately, hopefully, you'll be able to close the request file. Dave, you were going to say something about, you know, when you're looking at these types of procedures, you often find that it's purely focused, and actually is called a SAR process rather than an information rights process.
For sure, I've certainly found information rights processes only really focused on SARs, and potentially erasure might be the only other one that I've really ever seen. If you start looking at, well, what's your procedure on identifying whether you've got the right to portability, for example, and any other measure in between, or even documenting the procedure for individuals opting out of direct marketing. We all know it's an absolute right, you can stop direct marketing, but what's the procedure internally for that? If you've got separate databases or information in different places, are you got different teams be aware that the ability to communicate has been removed if there's kind of no central oversight to that? So I sometimes find that element lacking, and there is an over focus on SARs and to a lesser element erasure only. In particular with the SARs, I always kind of query with the client A, whether it'll, especially with COVID, does the SAR process still work with a home working environment? Firstly, is it still efficient? Does it still allow you to manage the process and respond accordingly? And then likewise, as we've seen with some of our clients where they've had serious data breaches, that naturally then sees either claim management companies or solicitors and so forth all throwing in the pennies with on subject access requests. Does your policy and procedure, or at least your procedure, is it scalable? Will it operate if you suddenly had an increase in SARs, or will it collapse? So it's just being mindful to the kind of additional consequences that may drain on whatever process you've got in place.
I wanted to get into this, everyone, because we obviously have a subject access request bureau, and we've got some great software that I think is worth looking at. But these bits in yellow, so, you know, everyone steps through the receipt verification ID, qualify the request. You know, then if it indicates a SAR, search for the request information. You know, again, if you haven't got good tools for doing that, it just causes a problem downstream, because you end up with literally gigabytes worth of data, because you've got a blunt instrument to search through your information assets. So again, the better tools you can get at that point, then the easier it is then to deal with the resulting information. What we end up doing, because we have the bureaus, we end up dealing with the very big or tricky requests. I think that our record is 238 gigabytes worth of data, which was hundreds of thousands of pages. So the first thing we do is catalogue them or give it a unique ID. Then we run through an exact match dedupe process, and that normally knocks out 40% of what's been found. Imagine emails, you know, everyone's copying to emails these days. And if they're identical, the system says, well, these are identical. I'll just keep one copy of it. But because you've catalogued them down here, you know that it's a duplicate. So each document in the document set gets kind of, I call it a fate. You know, this one went through to get reviewed and this one got knocked out as a dupe of, you know, this document here, you know, specific ID number. Then what we do is we've got a team of 30 people plowing through these things. We assign batches of documents to our reviewers who then review the documents, and they're looking for, you know, one, is this personal data, which is a whole different conversation for a few hours. If it is, whose personal data is it? Is it the requesters? No, is it a third party's? It's a third party's. Is it reasonable in the circumstances to release it? No, it's not. Right, I'll redact it. Equally, you know, can an exemption be applied to this information that I'm reviewing? Now, this is a human process and it takes a lot of time. And the more you can use technology to assist the human process, the better, really. And we have a platform we use. I've blurred out a lot of this stuff, but I wanted to kind of, if people haven't seen this before, but, you know, in this particular case, it was a small SAR of 7,235 documents, it says at the top, and each document is listed. And you can see from these numbers here, hopefully, that, you know, this particular one at the top, it occurs 54 times, or did occur 54 times in the data set. It's an email. So we're only looking at one copy. If you don't have the ability to dedupe the data set, you got it looked at 54 times. And if you've got a team on it, then you might have different people taking a different view on that one document. Again, it's fraught with errors, this process, the bigger these things get. With our platform, we kind of use key search terms. And if the document has got those key search terms in it, which could be the person's name, address, national insurance number, job title, words like redundancy, you know, victimization, we can put into the search terms. And then this gray box, this kind of second column in, shows how many times those words appear in each document. So you can basically top slice. You can use a lot of these tools to say, well, we're going to take a strategic approach to this. All those where there's more instances of these references will do first, you know, and then, you know, as you get further through the pack, then the documents tend to get less and less relevant. We then get an image of a document. I blurred this out because it's got personal data on it. You know, this might be a 6-page email, and our reviewers step through each page and they use these coding here. They literally draw a box around a passage of text and click, you know, it's disclosable, or, you know, I need a second opinion on this, or, you know, so we take the approach that we're marking out anything that isn't personal data. The stuff that's left is a personal data that is going to get disclosed. And then, you know, everything that they do on this platform is logged. We've got a complete audit trail of who's done what, when. And then once they've documents have been reviewed, they kind of click next and move on to the next document. But then all the documents go into a QA process where a second person checks the work of the first person. Again, it's not foolproof, but it's pretty good, and it's a step up from having, which we have seen, teams of people dragged in from the business to deal with a big SAR. Another factor we were working on, it might have been this one actually, this project, and one of the people who was a legal counsel in this organization found very disparaging remarks about him made by the people who had made the SAR, who were former owners of the business, and he resigned on the spot. So you got to think about what people are looking at, because some of it might be highly personal, highly confidential to the business. And again, you often find it's, you know, in a school I've been to, 15 administrators got dragged in to do a SAR. You know, you don't really want them looking at all this stuff, I don't think. So there's lots in this process, but I wanted to show this platform we use is absolutely fab. And we have 10 or 15 SARs on the go at once, and the teams of people kind of logging in, seeing the documentation. But if you can't get through, you know, if you haven't got the tools to dedupe, you know, it's a lot of work. And if you haven't got the tools to, you know, narrow down your search, again, it creates problems downstream. I don't know if anybody's got any experience of this. See, Adobe, we used to use Adobe. We do sometimes on very, very small SaaS, but it's not got as good control or tools. You can't control the process if you've got teams of people working on SaaS. You don't know who's looking at which document unless you rigorously control it. And there's no process for forcing something down a QA queue or forcing it into a second opinion queue where you get, a subject matter expert logging on saying, I understand, which might be the client, I understand the context of this and, I'm going to modify the way that the redactor has marked up the document. So the Adobe, anything works all right. And in the old days, of course, we used to use Tippex strips on paper, but we're highly impressed, and there are others with this Nuix platform that we use. On this question here, the point about historic handwritten documents, again, this system we use will OCR them, so we feed the PDFs into a massive hopper and they get read and converted into optical character recognized text, so they can then be addressed by the database in a digital way. So again, the last thing you really want is looking at handwritten notes. If you can OCR it and convert it into typewritten text, you can then apply logic to that within a database framework, which is what the Nuix platform is.
On the Nuix, do you want to just explain the how you can draw boxes over words of blocks of text? Because you do find within Adobe, if the information has not got in, if the information has been photocopied or not supplied straight as with a slightly skew with when it's converted into PDF, it can really make it difficult using Adobe to actually draw boxes around them, can't they?
Yeah, Adobe's awful for that. And again, because this is all kind of addressable digitized text, and the boxes work really well. And sometimes you have to draw multiple boxes to get an L-shaped piece, but. It's a good point that if they're going through and they're squiffy, then you might be obscuring stuff that should be released, because Adobe is, again, not very good at drawing. Well, in fact, it doesn't draw boxes that are on an angle.
So it's as a platform, I think it's rather user friendly. I've used it myself, not heavily, but I have used it myself for DPP and some of our clients. And I find it quite user friendly. I like the way it looks. I like the way you can apply stuff to it, and like I said, whether the box is round or highlight something for further consideration.
Yeah, and the good thing about it as well is you can have, I can have 20 people working one DSAR if it's, if there's a high priority on it as well, you can put as many people as you want. Whereas with Adobe, you really can't have more than one on it.
Yeah, this I'm sure there's more things you want to say about this. It's not our platform. Yeah, we just use it, so we don't sell it. We've got nothing, no relationship. Well, we have a relationship with this company that supplies it, but only so far as that they're a supplier of this platform. These blocked out things here are the data subject's name. Again, interesting. This project is called whatever it's called. It's got a name on the project somewhere. Buren, I think. So we don't use the name of the data subject in the title, because again, that again creates metadata that you don't really want there. And over the last two or three years since we've been running the SAR Bureau, we've learned an awful lot of really efficient ways to do subject dash requests. But again, we only get big, ugly, tricky ones, don't we, Kathy? Really.
We do. We just do the small ones on Adobe so that there's just one person concentrating on it. And, but it's very hard to revisit stuff or, single something out for a client opinion. Whereas obviously, I mean, we do it, but Nuix is much easier to do that on.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've just had my point clarified, if you can see the chat. So badly handwritten, if I've written something, an OCR wouldn't probably be able to interpret that, or something that's been scanned several times might have marks on it or hairs on it or paper clips obscuring bits of it. And again, they're just troublesome. But if they become the minority of the document, so if you've got 100,000 documents and only 500 are really poor, again, we can ring fence them off and put them through a human process. But if you can, anything you can do to make the whole thing more efficient, again, we found is really beneficial. There's reviewer fatigue, you know, that sets in, and it's a dull job. You know, again, we've got people that like doing it, and they do it through choice rather than being co-opted onto it, and all those kind of things can undermine your SAR process if you're not careful, in our experience. Yeah, I would love reviewing written care plans. Yeah, no, I wouldn't.
I would agree that if you're looking at a system, coming back to my earlier point, whatever system you've got in place, make sure it's scalable, because you might only have a handful of DSARs now, but what will it take before that doubles? And could you imagine, or could you facilitate a doubling of the number of DSARs that you receive, for example? So if you only get, say, 5 or 8 a year, how would you manage 16? How would you manage 24? Or if you had a serious incident, how would you manage 70 plus if you've got claims management companies chasing you in that sense? So I would be looking at scalability as well. And that's one thing that, as Kathy mentioned, the Nuix platform can allow you to have, because you can put more people on it than what you could do with through, for example, using Adobe and the licensing restrictions that Adobe will provide.
I should change this slide to trying to make data protection easy. That's what we aspire to, isn't it?
I'll just send them all in to us. That's much easier, guys.
Ollie, that's, I'm not sure, again, we're never sure whether that's of any use or interest when we finish these. We just wrap it on, really. We like we like doing this stuff. So we like talking about this stuff. But that's really, we said last week, we were trying to do a bit of a step through four areas. The feedback will tell us whether we've accomplished that or not, but that's really what we wanted to try and cover off today. I don't know what we're talking about next week. Have we got one next week?
Yes, we will have one next week, which is just a, correct me if I'm wrong, Miles, but a broad GDPR radio session, which is basically just a sort of free forum, isn't it, really? Discuss what's been in the news, some opinions, kick some things around that we've been working on, answer any questions, that sort of thing. So we will be back next week. We'll be back with that. So anything that we've not covered this week, please do come along next week and raise it, because we'll be able to kick it around in greater detail. But I think, as you say, Phil, we've probably at least stepped through those topics for this week.
I was just going to say, Ollie, that it's not only care plans, it's schools, isn't it? We find when we undertake a SAR for a school, absolutely. We got box files of paper delivered, handwritten. Actually, I think that they've been pretty successfully OCR'd, haven't they, Kath? We have tried a couple of agencies, haven't we? But we found one that does a good job with it.
Yeah, we've got all that sorted and lined up, yeah.
Yeah, good stuff, which means that I no longer have to do it manually.
we've done in the past. I think we've come across just about everything, haven't we, now, in terms of that. These are requests.
Yeah. But again, if you've got any questions you want to pick up on any specific points, and just engage directly with us. We want to try and make it easy for people. We want to try and share experiences. So if there's any questions, we will happily yak on to you about what we've found without any fee or anything. So do reach out to us. We are here to try and make things easier for people.
Absolutely. And if you don't do it directly, then obviously, as I say, there's next week's session, which is an opportunity for us all to come together and kick these things around again. So I think that's probably going to be it, isn't it? I don't know if there's anything else anyone has to add, any sort of final thoughts or comments. I mean, we've gone over by about 10 minutes, as we regularly do, I suppose. But if not, I would like to thank you both, Phil and Dave, for all your contributions, and Kathy for jumping on, as well as everyone on the chat contributed, everyone attending. It's always really great. We're starting to build a nice little network here of privacy professionals coming together and exchanging ideas. And as you quite rightly said, Phil, just trying to make it all easier for us all, really, share some knowledge. So thank you both. Thank you, everyone, for joining. And I think that's probably going to be it from us.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Weekend, and hopefully catch up next week.
Yeah, for sure. Take care, everybody. Thanks for joining. Good weekend. And we'll catch you all soon.